Morning, everyone.
A day or two early.
Morning, everyone.
Welcome. We do not have a quorum yet, but we will shortly. But we're going to get started. And I think we're going to just start where we left off with some guidance of our staff. We have done all the sames. We are working on similars. We have been through Bowser. Refresh my recollection. Did we finish Bowser? Was there anything else to do there?
We're finished except for riders.
Except for riders. Yeah. All right. Then I think this looks like a good PCA morning.
Madam,
I see PCA folks here. You want to direct us to where a good place to start would be on maybe starting with language and then into the... Well, do you want to start with language or do you want to start with the... We've been through and looked at... Should we start with language?
Might as well do language.
Okay, let's do language in PCA.
Money anyway.
Yes.
Madam Chair, any update on targets?
Monday. Sunday or Monday or Tuesday or Wednesday.
The meeting is
21, May 22.
The meeting is set.
Where do we go?
It's above,
where do we
it's above all our pay grades here. So.
Council, can you start us off?
Sure. If we start with language, we'd be in Article 4, and the first section would be the first section in R1 on the Senate side. It's one of the sections related to the product stewardship programs.
And if I remember correctly, that section 1 was determined to be not needed. If we could hear from PCA on that.
Madam Chair, committee members, for the record, my name is Kirk Adelka with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. The chair is correct. In the House, we did make a small change. There was discussion about what type of information was needed for the product stewardship organizations. And while there's the wider language on the Senate trade secrets, it was determined really the only thing that the agency needs is sales data, that type of information. And so later in the language here, you'll notice in the House bill that the language refers specifically to sales data and does still provide data privacy protection to the organizations, just done in a different way with a smaller area of information.
Well, Madam Chair, Mr. Kadelka, can I just ask something about that? Generally, when we classify data as private or non-public, we try to put a reference in the data privacy law to let people know where it's coded, and that's one of the reasons you'll see it. It isn't just that it says trade secret. If there's anything that you're classifying as private or non-public data, the people who work on that like to have that in. You'll see the transfer station data, solid waste records, customer lists. So regardless of whether you say trade secret or you say sales information, it seems like it would be a good thing to have it. I mean, that's a decision for the Conference Committee, but it would be a good thing to have it in the in Chapter 13 to let people know that the data privacy is coded somewhere else.
Madam Chair and committee members, if that works better, that works also. Our main goal was to change the scope of the information so that it was clear the agency was not looking for large amounts of trade secrets from the product stewardship organizations.
But, Madam Chair, Mr. Kadelka, you are making some data classified as private or non-public, and regardless, I guess that's a decision for the Conference Committee whether you want to include trade secret or just sales information, but I think regardless of that decision, I would think you'd want to have something in Chapter 13 to say that it's coded in that section or those sections, depending on which ones you pick up.
Madam Chair, committee members, we're open to that.
You just did a 180?
I think so.
About that completely.
Madam Chair, committee members, I mean, when we started off with this, we had... explained why we had done it. It was because it was the more limited information. In the Senate Judiciary Committee, there was concern that the agency was asking for large amounts of trade secrets from these companies to operate the program and that we would be requiring them to do that. That's not the agency's goal. The information that we need to make sure a product stewardship plan and organization is running it correctly is more the sales data to make sure that they are working towards their goals of collecting what is sold in the state. So we may have done it a little differently, but we're open to different language changes if it gets to the same place.
Well, Madam Chair, under this, I don't know, maybe that's for counsel or for Mr. Kadelka, but under this particular language, it says trade information submitted to the Pollution Control Agency. It doesn't require trade information to be trade secret information. It doesn't require that it's submitted, right?
Right. That's right. Mr. Chair, or Madam Chair, Senator Thomason is correct.
Okay. So potentially there could be some trade secret information submitted as a result of some type of application. Is that what we're thinking here?
Madam Chair, Senator Thompson, yes, the Senate carries the original language that the agency brought forward and talks about trade. If you look on page R60, you'll see there's a subdivision 13, and we define trade information. I'll let you get to page R60, and it's at the very top. And I think this is the important part here. The House has two other product stewardship. They have the carpeting and the primary batteries. But if you look what we've done with paint on 57.9, we say that trade secret as defined submitted to the agency under this section is non-public data. On the House side, you'll see that sales information provided is classified as private or non-public. I think whether you do either of those, whatever choice you make, is it just sales information or trade secret information, my recommendation is that you at least put a reference similar to what the Senate has in Section 1. And you can see that the thought is that whenever there's been a lot of times that the legislature makes certain information either non-public or private in other chapters or in other laws. But what the people who work on data practices laws prefer is to have it cross-referenced somewhere. And you can see that we already have that. If you look on page R1, you can see that the new paragraph B, transfer station, the solid waste records, and customer lists, those are all coded elsewhere but cross-referenced in the data practices law. So the people who kind of work with data practices can keep track of all the different exceptions to the general rule.
Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair, and maybe since we're dealing with kind of two different topics here, the trade secret and the sales, and it sounds like the agency is flexible, be a challenging motion to mingle the two. Maybe if council can draft the language to come back to this later, if they can work with the agency and
well,
covers both of them.
I guess the question is, do we need a cross-reference on sales information also, as well as trade secret information?
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Thomasoni, depending on which way you go, I would recommend that you at least include a cross-reference. I mean, that's a real technical kind of thing. But if you choose to do just sales information or trade secret, apparently they're only going to be getting sales information, which would be included in trade secret. I mean, if your sales information for a company or whatever, it's not necessarily public information. So we want to make sure we keep that non-public. So either way, whether you're just going to, I think if the agency is only going to collect sales information, I see no problem with the way the House has done it on page R60. The only thing I would do is, I would still do Section 1 on the Senate side, although you could just refer to it as sales information, if that's the route you're going to go. There are some other differences in the way we treat the architectural paint. And then, of course, the House has two additional items the Senate doesn't have for stewardship. But there are some other differences in the architectural paint stewardship program, too.
I think we maybe could take care of this. We had a motion
move Section 1. To move Section 1.
Section 1, and then the question would be, do we want to use the word trade secret or to use the word sale?
Both.
Or both.
And Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Thomas only pointed out earlier that nowhere does it require, as I understand it, trade secret information to be supplied. The agency is looking for sales. And so whether you say trade secret or sales or both, I don't think it matters.
So how about do we on section one on R1? So if we put would the language then be trade secret and sales information?
Kirk.
Madam Chair and committee members, just one other piece of information that might be useful. Other parts of the statute for data privacy does allow, if someone were to, in any dealings with the agency, submit trade secrets because of a permit application or any other reason they're interacting with the agency, they can ask the commissioner to protect that data. So if for some reason someone decides when they're putting together a product stewardship plan that they need to submit trade secrets, there still is an avenue to protect them. I just want to throw that out there as you're considering this, just so you know what all the options are out there to protect data, because the agency does believe that there are things that we should protect and that we do have those avenues for them.
Yep. Madam Chair, that's a general rule for agencies, but they do have to go through a process, I think, with the Commissioner of Administration, if I remember right. Or does that transfer to MMB too? One of the two.
And sales information here. Well, Mr. Knopf, is that the right language then? Would it be trade secret and sales information? Would we put it? Is that the same cross reference or no?
Madam Chair, Senator Thomasoni, it might be a little redundant because I think sales would be in trade secret, but I think it would be abundantly clear if you did both.
So then the trade secret and sales information online. 24.32.
Madam Chair, Senator Thomasoni, yes, trade secret and sales, but then you would also want to, on page R60, pick up the same, because you want this to match with what you have. And then so what you would do on page 57.9, you would say trade secret and sales. So you'd add in sales on 57.9, too.
So on the House side, on line 129.29, they have non-public, private or non-public. So do we need the word private?
Madam Chair, Senator Thomas, I think it's always good because they are different depending on what kind of an entity we're talking about. And so I think that you could say, I do think the reference on the Senate side is the right one because it's referring to 13.37, because that's where those things are defined, if I remember right. And so I think what you'd want to do is do the Senate language and say, private or non-public data.
After the word section?
Yeah, so it would be 57.10 on the Senate side. Delete is and insert are private or.
Okay, so Madam Chair, are we clear what we're doing here?
I think so.
Okay, then I'll make the motion to move section one on the Senate side as amended, and subdivision 13 on HR 60 as amended.
Questions? See any? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
This adopted. Moving right along, Council.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, do you want to continue with the stewardship stuff, or there's one section sort of in between if we go in order?
I think that would be a good idea. Let's stick with one topic. Yes, good idea. Okay.
Well, then on R48 is the carpet, the house only.
Okay. So this is a section, so we're carrying two sections, and we're carrying three, and you're
carrying one. Did we already do the paint? Did we already do the paint? No. Maybe we should just do the paint and get it over with.
But, yeah, Mr. Chair, that might be a good idea, because then you could set the pattern for the, if you do anything else with the rest. Because there are some differences also with the paint between the House and the Senate. There are some further differences. Generally, the language is very similar, but there are some differences. I think Ms. Taylor can go over that.
Mm-hmm. Why don't we hear the overall of, for the agency, because we are coming to something where we have a fairly substantial disagreement here. This is not same or similar. So if we have a context, we're better off. If you would like to help us out here.
Madam Chair and committee members, the agency has been working on product stewardship for a number of years now. The goal in a nutshell, and we'll talk just in general how we've structured these three different articles, there are a number of benefits that can be achieved through product stewardship. One is the environmental benefits. We've labeled a number of items as problem materials because of their toxicity, their challenges they pose in the solid waste infrastructure and system, or also the value that they can provide as recyclable materials. And so the agency has identified a number of items. And among those are paint, carpet, and batteries that we've moved forward with. Right now, the way the system is structured is product stewardship is the belief that product manufacturers are responsible for the end of life of their product since they are profiting from the sale of it. Instead of having, as in Minnesota, local units of government or individuals pay end of life fees that really do subsidize the proper management of them after they've done with their useful life cycle. The way that this is accomplished in our bill is that each or industry, in order for them to sell their product in the state, has to come up with a system, a product stewardship plan that details how they would manage the proper collection, disposal, and recycling of the materials. And we do this a little different than we do other solid waste programs. This is really a private-public partnership in the fact that it's not state regulations here that are outlining exactly what the program is. This is really left up to the manufacturers of the product to come together and find a market-based approach that they believe in, that works for their individual items, that they can accomplish their goals. The agency then has the chance of oversight of that, just to make sure we're agreeing that there are certain goals that need to be met, the collection's done in an environmentally safe way, and in other cases. So this is really provides the flexibility of the product manufacturers and not another program where it's just the state going about it. The benefits here is that with the manufacturer being responsible for the product, they will be able to get an economy of scale that others will not. Right now, for instance, for carpet, we have a hodgepodge of little areas here that might help with the collection or disposal recycling, or in paint where we may have a larger household hazardous waste program, but they're individual companies or local units of government doing that. With a product stewardship organization overall, we can do this on a statewide scale where there'll be economy of scale savings, so it'll reduce the end cost for everyone in the state. In addition, the benefit of product stewardship is when the manufacturer is now responsible for the end of life of the product, they can design the product in a way that's easier to recycle and dispose of in the long run to reduce the cost again for those that are doing the disposal. We've seen this occur in the computer industry with e-waste, where changes have been made in the hardware of computers because manufacturers are now responsible for the recycling of it, and we could see it in other products. There are some carpet could be made in other ways that make it easier for recycling or disposal if the industry is responsible for it. So the organization comes to the agency with a plan for how they would do this. The agency approves it after consulting with a number of stakeholders, including local units of government and others. Then, as we move on, in the case of carpet and paint, the product stewardship organization could put an assessment on their products as they sell it to help cover the cost of them running their programs. That then, at the retailer level, could be displayed on a receipt or not. That is up to the retailer. Again, the plan, the retailer is not, or sale point is not required to have a mandatory take-back program. Again, this is something voluntary on the retailers. It would be set up if they can reach an agreement with the product stewardship organization to move forward. The other item is it will use existing infrastructure. With that consultation period, the local units of government that have household hazardous waste would be a prime example of where the organizations can link into existing resources and already have an infrastructure up and setting. This would offset the cost for local property taxpayers. In the case of paint right now, counties are paying $5 to $6 million to dispose of paint. This cost could be largely, not entirely, but largely offset by the paint industry using that infrastructure.
Let me ask you a question on that. Counties are using $5 to $6 million for paint. We are not giving SCORE money. There's certainly not enough SCORE money going through what we are appropriating here to counties for that paint then. So this is relying on property taxes. Am I getting this right?
Madam Chair, committee members, that's correct. It's property taxes or special fees that are assigned when someone drops it off or on their solid waste bills. To continue, this would allow for collection across the state and remove this burden from local unit of government. Because right now, when there isn't a system to collect things, the counties are usually ones to step up and take over that responsibility. As we move forward, once this plan is in place, retailers and the products cannot be sold in the state unless they are part of the product stewardship organization. We have a similar situation already in place with e-waste. It's easy for retailers to go onto the MPCA website, find out what products are part of the organization, and a way for them to check. That, in a nutshell, the last piece is there is an administrative fee that the agency will charge back to the product stewardship organization to cover the cost of the agency's oversight and actions and compliance and enforcement actions. Much like EIS has done or some other product stewardship organization or plans in other states have done, the agency would bill based on their cost for the previous year. And we do have in the system here a way to limit that cost to the amount of the assessment fee, 5% of the assessment fee that the organization collects. And it would be just to cover the cost of our administrative folks and the compliance and enforcement folks to help run the program.
So do you have a total dollar that counties are paying over and above what they get in the SCORE dollars to manage waste?
Madam Chair, committee members, I'm going to ask for a little bit of help here.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Garth Hickel with the Pollution Control Agency. The counties report through the SCORE program every year an estimated amount that the total spent on solid waste management in the state, or more appropriately, recycling in this case, and that is generally around $58 million annually. That does not include some of the indirect costs such as staffing, facilities, and so forth, but that's more of the direct costs that the counties are bearing right now for the recycling programs.
Madam Chair and committee members, if it would be helpful, we could discuss a little bit why the agency's chosen some of the products that we have. There's agreement between the House and Senate on paint, along with the governor's recommendation, so I could skip that since I've highlighted a little bit. I would like to move to carpet since that's the first one that shows up on the spreadsheet. The Minnesota Chamber of Commerce has testified before that they would like to see product stewardship programs created on a national level on a voluntary basis. And the MPCA started that in 1999. The MPCA initiated a dialogue that eventually produced a national carpet recycling agreement in 2002. The agency invested the time to attempt a national and voluntary program. During that time, there was a 10-year agreement between the industry and a number of states and targets for recycling. However, recently, when that effort was attempted again to renew that memorandum of understanding, one could not be reached because of disagreements and an unwillingness by the industry to move forward and create a sustainable funding source for recycling and also agreement on the collection amounts and recycling goals. During that time, the agency invested thousands of staff hours working and creating this voluntary national program that is now no longer functioning, including serving on its board. In addition, the agency spent a large number of dollars in awarding grants and loans in excess of $1.5 million to support carpet recycling in the state, to create an infrastructure to help build upon that national piece. In addition, we've also adopted a carpet sustainability standard for public entities to encourage, which is something that the carpet industry is asked for usually during these discussions, to encourage purchase of carpet from responsible organizations. As a result, and where we are today is that without any agreement on a national level for carpet, in addition, the state right now disposes of about 86,000 tons of carpet, but only at maximum 7% of it is being recycled. The current system is not working, which has led the agency to the path that it's on now and moving forward the product stewardship program. The agency has modeled this after another state that had passed this, and that model was at that time approved and supported by the Carpet and Rug Institute, which is the industry group on the issue. And so we believe we have tried the other avenues, and it's only because of lack of success in those areas we are now moving forward on this. At this point, the other benefit that we have seen where a product stewardship organization is being created in another state is recycling is growing there. The amount of carpet that's being recycled on a national level, the growth is occurring in that state, not in other parts of the area. The other additional benefit is jobs. The state of Minnesota has a very strong recycling manufacturing base and recycling program that provides a large amount of dollars to the economy and jobs. And in the other state, there was an increase of from 3 recycling facilities to 15 after it was fully implemented in the law. That resulted in over 530 jobs. Looking at our numbers right now, we estimate that if the state received a 50% recycling rate in carpet in the coming years, we would add an additional 240 jobs created just for processing the carpet. That does not include if those materials then were shipped to a company that would find themselves in Minnesota to make other products. So there is an additional benefit here of not only helping consumers and local governments reduce the cost they pay for the proper disposal of end-of-life of materials, the environmental benefits, and carpet. We're looking at 1.5% to 2% in our mixed municipal landfills and 3% to 4% in our industrial construction. At a time when recycling is flat, these are large chunks of the recycling chain that we can receive gains at. And then three, there's jobs that can be provided that benefit the state as a result of the development of a program. The second product is battery recycling.
Let's concentrate on this one for a minute to see if there are questions, opinions. Since we are different on this one, we are getting into something where we're not same or similar.
We don't have it for a reason, I guess.
And we have it for a reason, I guess.
And I know when we moved the batteries in my committee, nobody voted for it, so it was pretty clear where we were on that one too. So I don't know. Maybe we should get some people to tell us why they don't want us to do this.
We could certainly do that. I think the question I will have is about who pays the property tax. I mean, there's a property tax issue here and there's a jobs issue here. So what are the other big issues here that we have to grapple with? I mean, that's the way I look at this. I mean, you all see our big picture issues here.
Depends what the picture is.
Is it in color or not?
Yes. If it's in color, then it's a done deal. But if it's not in color, then...
We need to do this in color, okay?
Madam Chair, committee members, right now, most frequently, the disposal cost for carpet falls on the consumer. There are some counties that do collect this. From our reports, 7 counties are collecting carpet, about 382 tons. The costs are variable, and it's really difficult to assess what it is. but it's when a consumer purchases carpet and has someone come in and install the carpet today, they, in their cost, that carpet magically disappears. But that's not done by free by the carpet installer. They're charging a fee, sometimes up to 50 cents per square yard, for them to properly dispose of it. As a result, we have a haphazard system of disposal and recycling in the state. There has been, we are lucky to have one carpet recycler in the state that has started to bring some type of recycling to this area, but it could be much more robust with a benefit for landfill space, cost savings to consumers, and environmental. And so with a product stewardship organization in place, the other state I mentioned charges 5%, a 5 cent square yard fee on carpet on time of sale. So this is, when it's done on a larger scale, the economy of scale kicks in with a system that really can drive down the cost for consumers, which is right now how it's being paid and not property taxes at this point.
Representative Hanson.
Madam Chair and Belkin, maybe you went over this. I had to step out for a moment, but how long has the voluntary effort been going on with carpet? And what has the success been? How long has the voluntary effect been with carpet stewardship, carpet, and what has the success rate been?
Madam Chair and committee members, the national organization that was created, the Voluntary National Program, National Carpet Recycling Agreement, was signed in 2002. At that time, we are right now at a 6.9% at best recycling rate in the state. Compared to other regions in the nation, that is one of the lowest. When we had the Carpet and Rug Institute here, a representative from them nationally, they did talk about the opportunities provided by that organization. It was really technical resources and negotiating. And when Senator Stevens specifically asked what type of resources come to the state to help, the answer was technical resources and networking. There is not anything coming into the state to really help it. Our recycling program today is from businesses like Brotex, the carpet industry, and the investment made by the agency over those 10 years.
Madam Chair and Mr. Kudelka, in terms of, and again, if you've covered this already, I apologize, but in terms of landfill volume, I mean, when we have carpets or batteries, I'm assuming that carpets take up more landfill space than all the battery issues that we have. Any idea on quantifying that?
Madam Chair and committee members, for the mixed municipal, your usual trash landfills, it's about 1.5 to 2%, which is a large segment. For industrial and construction landfills, it's 3 to 4% of the waste there is carpet. So it is a significant amount. So it makes sense for the agency to target that sector.
I think the carpet installers.
Madam Chair, have we agreed on with the paint same and similar, or have we not taken action on that?
Yeah.
What are the differences on paint in terms of language?
Madam Chair and committee, I can go back to paint real quick here. That starts on R55. As you flip through the section, the first difference, which is pretty small, is on R59. House language about halfway through the page, 129.6, and Senate language 56.21. There's just a different description there. The House probably should say about two-thirds away through the cost of paint by producers. It should be the Senate language, the cost of architectural paint by producers. All the way through the document, the definition is based on architectural paint.
Madam Chair, is that Mr. Kudelka, is that the only difference? Is it the Senate language is preferable?
Madam Chair and committee members, that's the only one up to that point. As the Senate and House Counsel mentioned, there are some differences later on data privacy, which we handled. And the last piece there is then on R1661. dealing with the administrative fee and how that's structured, that's the only other differences that I see on the paint, unless House and Senate research and staff notes anything else I'm missing.
So, Madam Chair, we could move the paint Senate language up through subdivision six before up to subdivision 16.
We could do that. We could do that. I think we're missing a beat here because Senator Thomas Dunnity wanted to hear from the people who are opposed to the carpet. So let's get that done first, and then
we can do this first.
So let's figure out what we're going to do as a big picture first. Yes, can you? Is there anybody who wants to put this on property taxes?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tony Quillis. Thank you for that setup, Representative Wagenius.
I didn't do that, did I?
Never do it.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the chamber issues are usually trying to go state by state, product by product, is confusing for our members, number one. Number two, we try and reach usually an agreement with the product manufacturers and the Pollution Control Agency, and I think you can see that in the paint example that you are discussing right now. That is not true in negotiations between the carpet and rug industry, as you've heard, and between, I'll venture off track a little bit and get ahead of you, into the batteries situation, where neither of those trade associations or any members of ours have come to agreement with the state agency. Batteries is really tough to do because I think there was a Hennepin County, and Mr. Hickel can correct me if I'm wrong, there was a Hennepin County waste sort, and I think there's somewhere upwards of 70-plus batteries that identified. And if you can think of a major retail establishment anywhere here in the state, whether it's dealing with home improvements or with just regular products, just the breadth of what we're talking about, whether it's involving toys or thermostats, anything that would have a battery in it or attached to it, and going through and just the enforcement of those products and whether or not who makes those batteries, is the manufacturer responsible for them, is it the manufacturer of the product itself, and the enforcement of that and through the chain of commerce, how that would be enforced. That's why we have such a problem with the battery section. We've tried to work with the agency, and I just don't see a conclusion of us being able to reach it there, Madam Chair. And same thing on the carpet. We're a little bit concerned also on how this would be implemented in rural Minnesota and how we would work through that, Madam Chair.
When you look at it from a financial point of view, and this is a finance committee, the impact of batteries on our counties is not particularly large. The impact of carpeting on our counties is particularly large because it's bulky and expensive to deal with. It means we have to have a lot of landfill space or a lot of incinerator space, and we're just saying goodbye to the resource. So let's concentrate on the one where we could save counties a good deal of money, and that would be carpeting. Besides the paint, where we could save counties a good deal of money. Carpeting is the other place where we could save counties a good deal of money. Creating jobs, too, but we'd save counties a good deal of money. So from a public policy finance point of view, and from a chamber point of view that does not like us to charge property taxes, I'm having trouble reconciling your testimony.
Madam Chair, like I said, I just want to go back, and we've been trying to work with the agency, and we just haven't been able to go through that and find that agreement between the agency and the industry. There's only one, there's no other state in the nation that does batteries. And in terms of other states, in terms of carpet, it was California, and they have been having some issues with their program. So we're just concerned about the implementation of that, like I said, and especially in rural Minnesota, and especially with do-it-yourselfers. It might be easy at some place where there are, in the metropolitan area, where there are points of sale that we can track. But in rural Minnesota, we are really concerned about how the implementation and how this would work. I also think that Mr. Hickel can correct it in terms of percentages of what this is in the landfill. I don't think it's was under 10, I think, referenced, or maybe 7%.
That is actually a lot. Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair and Mr. Quillis, as I'm listening to you, it sounds like the battery issue is kind of an if. If we did this, how would we even do it? Or there's a lot of challenges there. But your testimony on the carpet is more of implementation challenges, not... It's not impossible. It may be just difficult, and there may be challenges between rural and metro. That's a different question than how do we do product stewardship with a multitude of different venues of distribution and manufacturers. If you have to choose between the two, which one is more ready for launch?
Mr. Chairman, it's like trying to choose between who's my favorite, my mother or my father. That's kind of a tough situation to go through. I think the implementation of both of them is going to be tough, specifically in the batteries, but I also think so in carpet to go through and do that. So, I mean, I not to evade the question, but I'm not going to say that one is better than the other or one is easier to implement than the other. I think they both have unique challenges.
And, Madam Chair, if the PCA could answer that question.
Madam Chair and committee members, we'll start with carpet. On R51, you will see the stewardship plan. This really is set out into the future, into March of 2015. So there are 2+ years for the carpet industry to put together a plan. And then for the challenges dealing with the outstate area, we do provide an additional year for it. There is some infrastructure on carpet in place, but the system is built by the agency. It is not creating a hard top-down, this is the way it needs to be done system. It is based on flexibility so the industry can move forward. There is also the understanding by the agency that we will not be at 50% on year two. There will be some time to build in there. And as we've seen a success from California, they've had a number of presentations that have shown the success and growth of recycling in the area and already starting and seeing results in their rural area pilot programs in 6 counties where they are paying for the cost of trailers, transportations, monthly reporting, filling up faster than expected in some counties, and roll out to all rural counties expected after the pilot project is complete. This is not recreating the wheel. We recycle a number of products in the state. E-waste are large, bulky items, the large TVs. There are ways that can be gained. There are county locations that can be built upon in terms of carpet. Batteries, there is a sooner date for them to move forward the program a little earlier. But the agency believes we have a rechargeable battery program in the state already. And so there is some infrastructure in place, although it is not going to the level of recycling that we would like, but they can build upon that also. It's not recreating the wheel in terms of batteries. So the agency does believe with the flexibility allowed in the programs, the amount of time that these programs have to get up and running, and the state having a strong recycling program to base off of to start with, that they can build off, that this is a very doable piece. And again, we do understand that it's not going to be 50% in year two recycling. There will be some time to build it up. But it's doable, and it's something that we should do, we believe.
Madam Chair and So there is a phase-in, and there's a longer phase-in for Greater Minnesota on the carpet. I see the counties are here. I'd like to hear from the counties in terms of their perspective on costs associated right now with the status quo.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Annalie Garlitz, and I'm with the Association of Minnesota Counties. Thank you, Representative Hansen, for your question this morning. As Mr. Kudelka said, there are six counties that are doing this right now. I think the way that the language is set up in the bill, and I forgot to bring it up with me, the way that it's set up is it allows counties to enter into agreements with the manufacturers so that we can have some flexibility to set up these programs. And I have heard from some counties, and they're curious. They want to see how this is going. They want to hear from the six counties. They want to hear more. Save the landfill space that we have existing, as Representative Waginia said, that it is a resource, and we don't want to waste that landfill space resource. So I think that the language allows those counties to work out an agreement and allow that flexibility with the carpet manufacturers. And I have heard from a couple outside of the six, just as we've been talking about this, that have indicated that they would like to go forward and set up some collection points and get going to see how they could make this work. In terms of answering your question specifically, I'm not aware, just because the way that the legislation is written, it allows us to enter into those agreements, and maybe Mr. Hickel's been privy to more of those conversations about specifics.
Well, did I hear you say that there's six counties doing this already?
Yes, that's correct.
So why do we need a law?
Well, Madam Chair, members of the committee, right now those counties are paying for it out of either their score dollars or through their property taxes. And so we have a wide variety of duties that we're trying to accomplish and items that we're trying to recycle and services that we're trying to offer residents. And this is one area where counties are reaching out and trying to expand the program, and they're paying for it. And if we can get some assistance from the manufacturers, that will allow us to do more.
I don't have any suggestions because I know by the time we got to my committee, the carpets were already gone, and then the batteries went out in my committee. And so we're here with paint.
We're here with paint, but we have a problem, and we're also here to problem solve.
Do we know where those six counties, what six counties are currently, where they're located? Madam Chair?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we do not have those counties offhand, but we could certainly determine that quite quickly.
Is there any other people who would like to testify on this carpet subject? Members may want to make comments on it.
Madam Chair, committee members, there's a letter I'd like to share, if that's okay with the committee. I only have a few copies. This is from Brotex, one of the carpet recycler in the state that has experience that does outline some of their thoughts on it, if that would be okay with the committee. They couldn't be here today, unfortunately.
Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair, as with many things, I think this comes down to who pays and continues to pay on things. And Chair Tomasoni, I understand, you know, you took the batteries out. Maybe that's a decision we stay with. And carpet has the larger volume and impact and cost. We've agreed on paint. We've got three things here. It seemed to me if we had to make a choice, keep carpet and let the batteries go.
Just a minute, Madam Chair. Just a point that who pays? It's the consumers. You know, somebody's going to pay, and it ends up with us. So just make that clear that manufacturers, somebody else, not going to be paying it. Will consumers end up paying it? So.
Well, and on that point, it's the consumers who purchase it, not the consumers who are not purchasing it. So we have people we have people who are paying through their property taxes for services that they don't use.
Yeah. And Madam Chair, that the ad valorem tax that everybody is paying, and that's a good point. We're all the taxpayers are paying for it. Is that right? I don't know.
Well, I know when I dumped my carpet at the dump, I had to pay for it.
Why don't we move on? I don't think we can solve this thing here. I'm not going to. I think we're biting off, Madam Chair, just a little too much too soon. And I think the paint thing we agree on, but that's just me. Right?
I think the question of property taxes is always with us, unfortunately, because we're a finance committee and we are trying our best at another level in the tax committee to. Keep people's property taxes down, and that I think we have a kind of a fundamental agreement on. That's one of the areas where we share. We share it. So we have been given this lump of a problem that raises property taxes while other people are trying to lower them. So the question is, do we participate in the that struggle for property taxes or not? And I think that's the basic question. I don't see batteries doing much in a property tax. They're too small. Carpet's bulky, huge. So that, weigh in on the property tax issue very much there. But boy, here it is big.
Madam Chair, just a question. Maybe somebody can, maybe Mr. Hickel can help us. What is the expected cost per yard? I mean, or whatever the unit measure would be for the carpet recycling.
Madam Chair, Representative Falk, if you're asking for what the stewardship assessment would be, based on what consumers are paying in California, it's 5 cents per square yard.
I guess
just for my information, is California the only state that's doing this today?
Madam Chair, Senator Metzen, that is correct. There are there's a bill before the New York legislature, and about half a dozen states are suggesting that they'll take this up in 2014.
Kind of pioneers here.
Hey, that's us.
That's like us, yeah.
That's us.
We're if I could ask, I mean,
Jimmy.
Typical carpet purchase, I mean, every house is different, but I mean, you know, at 5 cents a yard, you'd have to go and have 20 yards at, you know, for a buck, and then, I mean, so what, you know, is the fiscal impact to a typical purchaser, I mean, when they make that purchase?
Madam Chair, Representative Hogg, I think you identified that. Obviously, it's extremely variable, but looking at shifting from the costs that are currently being borne now by consumers who want to do the right thing, they are paying a substantial amount of money to ensure that that gets recycled. So this just simply would shift that cost to all carpet purchasers, and obviously 5 cents per square yard is significantly lower than 50 cents per square yard that consumers who want to do the right thing now are currently bearing.
Well, thank you.
Madam Chair, committee members, for the 10 by 10 room, that would be $5 for a 10 by 10 bedroom. for the cost there. The benefit of a statewide program, which is instead of this just here and there, maybe a one company or a couple counties and that, is that it's, again, economies of scale, the efficiency that can be built in there. Right now, our understanding is consumers pay on average 50 cents per yard of their carpet to be disposed of, and that's built into their installation fee. So by creating a statewide program that is run in a more efficient manner than a haphazard, each person having their own system for disposal, we can drive down the cost for the consumer.
So if it becomes a resource, then the cost is driven down, is what you're...
Madam Chair and committee members, that is correct. And efficiencies, too, by creating a system that works together instead of apart from each other.
Representative Fall.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Kudelka, if I said for a 10 by 10 room, you're talking 10 foot by 10 foot. The math, I think it was $1.67 versus $5. So.
Madam Chair, committee members, sorry, I didn't do the change from feet to yards.
So it was less than...
Correct.
Thank
sorry.
You.
This would cost a consumer $1.67 versus what did you pay to dump it?
Plus fuel to get to the dump.
I paid cash, that's all I know.
He paid cash.
It's trash. They only take cash to the dump.
The cost seems relatively reasonable. I mean, compared to what we're getting as far as overall economies of scale to deal with the problem.
I won't say that.
I think not.
Okay. We got to add a little humor to this. So. I'm not sure I got three votes on this side, so we could either do the paint now or we can wait and go to the next section. So.
Okay, well, I think we can do the paint now, but I think that we need to be taking our responsibility to keep... to be in tandem with our tax committee that is trying to lower costs for property tax payers. And if they are trying to lower costs and we're trying to raise them, it does not seem that we are in tandem. So perhaps we can have some discussions about trying to lower the cost, which is one thing that we know, use a resource, create jobs, and the big deal is work in tandem with our tax committee. So those are how we will have some further discussions about that.
Yeah. Tax committee is kind of its own animal.
We're our own animal, too.
I know, that's why. Yeah. We probably can't interact here, but we'll have discussions as we go, but I think we can't. I think it's too early for us to be making a decision on the carpets and on the batteries here.
I'll move Section 64 of the Senate language for paint stewardship up through line, including 57.24 right before the administrative fee.
Any questions by members? I don't see any discussion. All those in favor say aye.
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 Any opposition? It's adopted. Let's go work right on the next section there, then, Representative Hansen. We went up through section...
up through subdivision 16, that was the fee. Up to subdivision 16, so on R60, so I did not include
Let's
the
go
fee.
Ahead and just get the rest of this done.
So, I'd like to hear from the agency on the fee, which is which language they prefer.
Madam Chair and committee members, the agency, the House had the luxury of the agency spending a little bit more time on this and had the most recent version of how we went through on the administrative fee. This is set up in the way that we would like it to be organized. That would be our preference.
What, Senator?
The House, sorry.
Well, there's a little difference. So subdivision 16?
I'll move subdivision 16.
Mr. Chair, a couple of significant differences. And this was, Mr. Mueller's not here, so I'll speak for him. If you look on 58.12 to 58.16, Mr. Mueller thought it would be better to, in the environmental fund, we get an environmental fund statement. We can keep track, the fiscal analyst can better keep track of where, you know, once it goes into the special revenue account, it's difficult to track the money. And so Mr. Mueller thought that it would be better to put it in the environmental fund, the same as we do for the e-waste fees. And then also the Senate, the appropriation, the statutory appropriation is only for 2 years to kind of have them come back, see how much they really are collecting and to spend. So that's probably the significant difference between the two. Otherwise, the House language, if you look above that, is organized. I think paragraph D on the House side and E on the Senate are where there's kind of more of a policy difference between the two. And I just wanted to call that to your attention.
So are you suggesting that we add paragraph E to the House language?
Well, Mr. Chair, if you did paragraph E instead of D on the House side, it would be, I guess that would take care of some concerns over the Mr. Mueller on tracking the money. And then also, and we did this similar with the e-waste, where we gave them a statutory appropriation for a couple of years until they kind of know about how much they're going to collect. And then it became a direct appropriation after that, which gives the legislature a little more control over the money.
So let's give me an idea what you're suggesting we adopt take the House language and some
Senate
language.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, it would be instead of D and instead of the language after D on 130.25, it would be the language after E on the Senate side. So you would replace that and otherwise adopt the House language.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I think one of the challenges there that we've saw, at least, you know, going through this year in testimony, was that the Environment Fund was kind of a black hole. Things go in and you don't exactly know how they're moving and what's paying for what. And I think that was part of the reason maybe why we didn't put it that way, just because, you know, at least for the initial period, we thought we could have a little bit of better time tracking it.
Madam Chair, Representative Falk, I understand the concern with the Environmental Fund, but if you think that's a black hole, you should see the Special Revenue Fund.
Well, and Madam Chair, I think if you look on line 130.26, it says to a product stewardship account in the Special Revenue Fund. So that would be a line item that would be trackable in the House language, which I believe the agency said they preferred.
I would think maybe a compromise here would be the House language in the product stewardship account for the reasons of the black hole, but then do the Senate language for appropriation. How would that work?
I'm ambivalent here, but I'm just trying to figure out the best way to do it. So,
I think, Madam Chair, that would be a reasonable compromise, because then they would have to come back in 2 years and tell you to get an additional appropriation. So you'd at least get them back here. Tell them what they need.
So what's the motion?
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Tomasoni, it would take all the House language except for the very last sentence on 130.26 to 130.28. And then what you would do is adopt the Senate sentence, the last sentence in the Senate side, 58.15 to 58.16. So you would give them 2 years of a statutory appropriation, and they could come back and either extend that longer or go to a direct appropriation for the money they receive from this.
So the motion would be the House language in subdivision 16 with the addition of the last sentence in the Senate language.
Strike the last sentence from the House language and insert the last sentence from Senate language. I'd make that motion.
Does everybody understand the motion?
Saxhog Beavitt. There we go.
Sorry.
It's the Saxhog Falk motion.
There we go.
It's the Saxhog Falk motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
The opposition.
Sorry.
It's carried. House Counsel could give us some suggestions of where we continue with PCA since we finished the, we have not finished the stewardship issue, but we are setting it aside.
Madam Chair and committee members, there is one more part with the product stewardship language dealing with the reporting, which is somewhat similar. On R67, Section 91 on the House side on the top and 65 in the Senate, that's part of our reporting that we need to do back to the legislature on all the programs. Well, I know there hasn't been agreement yet on two of the three that is reporting language. Just there was talk before about the agency having to make sure to follow up with the legislature. The agency did propose that we would check in with the legislature on the programs. We do believe that is important, and that's language we'd like to see also.
Are they the same?
Madam Chair and committee members, the only difference is the programs that are included in the reporting. And that's, again, the decision of whether or not carpet or batteries is included in the final product. But it, other than that, they are the same.
So for now, we should adopt the Senate language.
Would you like to make that motion?
Sure. Is that Section 65? Mm-hmm. Okay, I'll move Section 65 on the Senate side.
Senator Tomasoni has moved Section 65. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. The opposition is adopted.
And then, Madam Chair, we did skip a section to go to the stewardship stuff. So if you want to go to page R45, there's a House-only section that was from the PCA's policy bill. And it continues on to R46, and the change is actually on R46 on the top there, dealing with clean water funds and federal funds.
Madam Chair, if I could just explain the Senate position on this. The Senate has adopted this. In fact, last night in Senator Cohen's in the subcommittee, the Senate adopted the same language to the legacy bill. The Senate felt that that since this is dealing with money in the, from the legacy appropriation, that it would be more appropriately carried in the legacy bill. And that was kind of the position of the Senate rather than carrying it in the appropriation bill. Because this is Chapter 114D is the Clean Water Legacy Act. And so it is being carried, the identical language is being carried right now. I guess it's up to you if you want to adopt it here, but the identical language is being carried in the clean or in the legacy bill, Senator Cohen.
And are we're talking Section 85 right now, right?
Madam Chair, Senator Tomasoni, yes.
Sometimes it's good to have belts and suspenders. Sometimes it's good to have belts and suspenders just in case.
I'll move the House language in Section 85.
Okay. Senator Tomasoni moves the House language, Section 85 on R45. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? No opposition, then that is adopted. Council?
And then the next section would be on R68. It's a Senate-only provision on the closed landfill investment fund.
R68?
R68, yep. It's Section 68, Senate side.
And Madam Chair, this is purely technical on the Senate side. It's the it's basically removing language on how the money got to the closed landfill investment fund to begin with. Not necessary to do it, just the Senate thought to clean that up.
This is our Section 68. Representative Hansen?
Move Section R68 of the Senate language.
All those in favor say aye.
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 The opposition?
Madam Chair, the next section would be on R70. It'd be Section 96 on the House side and Section 71 on the Senate side. And there's really only one difference you'll see on page R71. on paragraph C, starting on line 62.25 through 62.26 on the Senate side. They have some additional language stating that the Commissioner of Admin may charge the agency for actual staff and other costs related to the disposal of property under the paragraph.
And Madam Chair, I'll just explain why the Senate's carrying the additional sentence. It is my understanding, I think it was from Mr. Kadelka, that the Commissioner of Administration had requested this language to make sure that their costs were covered, because this allows the agency to ask the Commissioner of Administration to dispose of the property, and this was to make sure that their costs were covered.
Representative Hansen.
I'll move Section 71 of the Senate language.
Hang on a second before you move that. I don't know if I like that. What?
Well, the agency wanted it.
I think you'll like it.
Well, this is the kind of stuff you don't like, though, Senator Metzen.
Oh, more government intervention.
Commissioner may charge agencies for actual staff and other costs related to disposal of property when they already got people working there. I mean, is this?
What's the Senate language, though?
I know. Go ahead, Mr. Knopf.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Tomasoni, the reason for it is that because there will be some costs. I mean, the agency isn't in the business of buying and selling land, but the Commissioner of Administration is. They take care of other state lands other than DNR lands, because the if you look on 62.4, it allows the agency to request the Commissioner of Administration to dispose of property. And this was just to clarify, because there are going to be costs of doing that. And this is to clarify that they can be assessed for those costs, because they're also going to receive money from the property. And generally, we do try to charge, whenever the state sells land, we try to assess the costs of the sale from the sale proceeds. And all this would do is allow the Commissioner of Administration a portion of the proceeds to take care of the actual sale, and then the PCA would end up with the net. If the PCA was selling it directly, they would have to shoulder those costs as part of the sale. And you can see on 62.26, one of the differences is that the sentence is the net proceeds, so it's the net after the cost of the sale.
The Mets is okay with it. I'm okay.
I'm okay. Yeah.
Representative Hansen.
I renew my motion for Section 71 of the Senate language approval.
Representative Hansen renews his motion. Up Section 71 of the Senate language. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? Adopted.
Madam Chair, the next section would be the first of the silica sand provisions on page R73, Section 102 on the House side and Section 74 on the Senate, and this is the creation of the model standards and criteria. And there are technical and then some significant changes as well, or differences.
Go to work, sexy.
Would you repeat that, Council?
Sure. It'd be on page R73, sections 102 and section 74, and they're technical and then some significant differences. And I can go through those if you'd like.
Okay. We might as well get this done.
We're in the process of trying to figure out exactly what the negotiations are on this thing. We thought we had something going yesterday, and it's kind of falling apart. And so we can move the sames, I think, if we want to move the sames. Did we already move the sames?
This is sections. You're talking about Section 74 and 102. Close enough for government.
I'm okay with doing those.
Let's work on these sections a bit. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think they're very close. Just a couple. If we look on R73, I think those are the same. If that's that be correct,
Madam Chair, not quite. What the Senate does, if you look at the definition on 63.32, you'll see that the Senate applies it to a couple of sections.
We have an additional section in our bill that deals with an EAW for silica sand projects, Section 75, that's a Senate only, and it picks up, it makes sure that those definitions apply to that. Actually, I thought that was supposed to be, I think that's there's a typo on the Senate side. It should be two instead of and. Because they also picked up the technical assistance ordinance and permit library to make sure that those definitions apply to all the silica sand provisions that are in here. I think that should have been 168 to 116.69. I'm not sure why it says and. The other difference is Senator Thomson's request. If you look on 142.13, the House defines mining as mining. If you see excavating and mining silica sand, and Senator Tomasoni kind of brought that up in division when we were talking about this, that we shouldn't really have mining being defined as mining. We should describe what mining is if we're talking about a definition. So if you see on the Senate side, we removed the term mining, so we're explaining what mining is, but we're not defining mining as mining. That was a Senator Tomasoni initiative.
Madam Chair, I think if we went to R-74, subdivision 2, I like the Senate language. I think it's a little more detailed, recognizing the differences around the state. I think when we get into the various subdivisions after that, they are the same on R-74. Is that correct?
That's correct. There is also the difference between the House has the EQB being behind it and the Senate has the four agencies.
And that's we would prefer the EQB, but with the Karst language, I think, would be a reasonable compromise there.
Representative Hansen, say that again.
I think if you look on the top of page R-74, standards of criteria, 143 through 1.1 through 5, before we get to the including on the Senate side, on line 64.26 through 64.30, the standards and criteria shall be different for different geographic regions of the state. The unique karst conditions and landforms of southeastern Minnesota shall be considered unique when, kind of a double unique there, were compared with the flat scoured river terraces and uniform hydrology of the Minnesota Valley. The standards and criteria developed shall reflect those differences in varied regions of the state.
You are suggesting we adopt that?
Yes. With the House language on 143.1 through 143, it's going to have to be drafted to fit in there, but then that criteria differences language from the Senate.
Do we actually need all the people from the EQB when we have the Commissioners of Natural Resource, Health, and Transportation already in on the Senate side?
Representative Tomasoni, the EQB makes them work together. Otherwise, I think they have silos between the agencies where they're there. And I think the governor's proposal had the EQB being the responsible authority to pull these folks together.
And Madam Chair, we will just remind Senator Tomasoni that there was just some concern on the Senate side of whether we should have the EQB, which includes citizen members and a number of other agencies, or whether we should have just the four agencies that are really responsible for this area create this together rather than bringing it to the full EQB. And that was the reason the Senate does not have the EQB and has those four agencies listed.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking right now.
Yeah.
If you would remind us, members, how many agency heads are on the EQB compared to the citizen members?
Madam Chair, I think actually we can find it in the bill. If you look, where the EQB is being transferred, you can see that. I'm trying to remember. I want to say eight agency heads, but I'm not positive about that. Should be in 116C, so that would be.
I think we have some help here.
Sounds good.
EQB.
Madam Chair, Senators, I'm Bob Patton, Executive Director of the Environmental Quality Board, and I believe you're asking me to, from memory, give the membership of the EQB.
Well, just how many agency heads versus how many citizen members?
There are 9 agency heads and 5 citizen members.
5 citizen members. So the vast majority are agency.
Correct.
Appointed all by the same governor.
Yes. Oh, well, excuse me, Madam Chair, members. The memberships of the citizen members are rolling memberships. So we have, I think now they have all been reconfirmed by this governor. But
I was actually talking about the agency heads.
Oh, yes. Thank you.
Appointed by the same governor and are in vast majority.
Thank you.
Mr. Cadell.
Madam Chair and committee members, from the administrative, from our point of view, it would be very important to have EQB continue in this role. They really have led and spearheaded the administration's efforts on silica sand. A lot of our knowledge rests in EQB on this subject. As Representative Hansen mentioned, they really have broken down silos, and we really are creating a picture that crosses all the agencies. If EQB was taken out of that leadership role, I think we would end up actually stepping backwards on the issue, and it would take more time and effort to move forward on it. I think it would be a loss to the greater understanding of the silica sand issue with the EQB not being in the lead.
Just yesterday, there were so many complaints on the House floor about water being, different agencies having different responsibilities with regard to water. And it seemed to me that if you had those agencies sitting down together in one room with their heads together, you would resolve a lot of those differences a lot quicker than if you took it a staff level up, and it does make sense to me. Let's piece instead of doing this in bulk, because there are several issues involved here. Let's just start and just go as far as we can where we have total agreement, both same or similar, and then get to the EQB section. So I think that Senator Tomasoni is right in deleting the word mining on 142.13. And we have a change in the Senate on line 6332 and 2. How far can we get in this line? And then there's obviously the statutory sites. How far can we get in this where we have agreement? Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair, I think we could move the Senate language, Section 74, Subdivision 1, to get us started on it.
Right. That would start the process, which I always think is easier to start with something.
Madam Chair, the only thing I wanted to just be clear on, the Senate codes this in the PCA section, the House codes it in the EQB section, so depending on that decision later, we would have to. That would just be a technical. I just want to make sure you understand that we'll pick up the right references. But
we'll consider the references later. We will assume that is a decision to be made.
Sure.
All right. Representative Hansen.
I would move that per further action to approve Section 74 of the Senate language, Subdivision 1.
Subdivision 1. Okay. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposition? It's been adopted. Now let's talk about this.
starting on line 6432 and 142.6. Is there any difference there? All the way down to R75, 65.30.
Madam Chair, there are no differences in the criteria. So those lines would be identical.
Let me make that motion. And are there any references there that are different? No. So, Senator,
Madam Chair. Senator Thomas, the only thing is on 65.3, we are defining what's going to be designated as drought streams down there. Is that
65.3?
It's the same on both sides, it's similar, but the question is it's pretty encompassing.
We're getting some feedback on this right now, aren't we?
Well, Madam Chair, I think that I realize that there's issues relating to a permit discussion going on. This is the standards and criteria recommendations. So I think that is independent of whatever we do in the next few minutes or hours or days.
Weeks, months.
Weeks.
Not weeks. On the 20th.
See, up in the range, they say don't plant the tomatoes until June 15th.
That's a mistake.
Well, that's because we get frost until then.
I know, but you plant them and you
get
going.
Summer starts.
We're going to have some discussions
about tomatoes.
Well, tomatoes, I mean, I got to tell you guys, the peach tree in my yard is coming out just beautifully that I planted last year. And peaches aren't supposed to grow in Minnesota. Planted it last year, and it's just...
You got grapefruit trees, too? Orange trees?
No.
Exactly. Have that big yard.
Cover it with carpet.
All right, here we are today.
Okay, I think we have a motion by somebody here. Yeah. Who is it?
We get paid by the motion, you think.
Senator Saksak makes a good point because what's this discussion about Class 2A water and
65
designated rules and the pollution? I realize this is something they're supposed to take a look at. Does anybody object to this being in there? That's okay. All right. Okay. All right. If that's the case, then we can, I think, where did you want to go?
64.32. Right. 64.32, 143.6 in the House. They're the same on both sides. That's what I get. And to 65.30 or 144.4 in the House side. And we leave those are the same. Mm-hmm. And I have a motion from Senator Saxhog to adopt that language. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
The opposition. That language is adopted.
Doesn't matter.
Now we get into questions about the EQB.
Chair, if Mr. Patton could, since he's here representing the EQB, give the administration's perspective on this language and what was in the governor's supplemental budget.
Madam Chair, committee members, on this piece here, it is the EQB that was proposed to be the one that assembles the technical team. Having looked at, while there wasn't specific language from the governor's piece, it was more in the rider language of the appropriation. One of the items we do look like a note there is the technical team assistance being comprised of. There is some question of whether we want to be very prescriptive of who's on the technical team. Each project may be different. And so if we were to, on the House side, the lines 144.9, the technical assistance team through 144.13, not dictate exactly who's on there, but just list that there has to be folks with those areas of expertise. Again, just to make sure we're not pigeonholing us into the right people in the room when something new may come up. It still allows that there have to be folks in addition to state agencies there. But again, we would be afraid of pigeonholing the wrong people in the room.
Madam Chair, on the way the House language was written is it's up to 7 members to be chosen from the following entities. So it's not saying each of those entities would be at the technical assistance team. I think the House language gives the flexibility to the areas of expertise, and it provides explicitly that they can be drawn from the University of Minnesota or Minsky. So the intent there was not to say each one of those is there, but to draw from the agencies. And in the House, it was important to have specifically that the Department of Transportation would be involved because of impacts on roads, the Department of Health for air quality, Border Water and Soil Resources for soil and water issues, CCA for permitting and DNR for permitting and water quality protection. So it could be from each of those agencies, but they are named there, so we don't run into a situation where that's not our responsibility. We're not involved in that.
But Madam Chair, just to address that on the Senate side, the Senate is not as prescriptive as that. It allows more flexibility. One of the issues with the House language is that it says from the following entities, so it would exclude other entities that could also, that these people could be federal agencies. And I'm not sure what else is out there. The Senate decided to keep it broad and allow the commissioners the authority to appoint whoever they want to it. We do carry the same language as the House, where the majority must be from a state agency, but it doesn't dictate which agencies they would have to be from.
Madam Chair and committee members, that echoes our concern, is if we wanted USGS or others, especially when we're dealing with the karst areas or maybe local expertise that we may want to call upon on a project, that would be beneficial. We agree. Transportation and these other departments need to be in the room also. It's just we want to make sure we have the right people depending on the cause.
Madam Chair, I think our concern on the federal agencies was that we can't direct them to do anything by name. But I would be open to having some acknowledgement that other entities could serve federal agencies, could be part of that pool that they're drawn from. But I know as a state law, we can't direct the feds to participate in something, but we can maybe just say as a general and federal agencies.
Hey, Madam Chair, we know that one of the citizen members of the EQB is from U.S. Fish and Wildlife.
Is that good, bad, or indifferent?
My brother.
We're going to be moving the House language.
I don't know. They don't like the House language. They don't like the House language.
No. I mean on the EQB.
On the EQB.
Yes.
We got at least one vote on our side.
Well, I am thrilled to hear that.
Madam Chair, I just want to point out one technical difference on the Senate side, too. If you read that last sentence on the House side on 144.13, a majority of the members must be from a state agency and have expertise. There was some concern on the Senate side that only a majority have to have expertise. I don't think that was the intent of the language, so there was a technical amendment on 66.1 to make sure that it's a majority of the members must be from a state agency and all of the members must have expertise, just to make sure that technically reads right, that somebody wouldn't misinterpret that that sentence. So I just wanted to point out there was a technical, it was brought up by a committee member. They were concerned that it said that only a majority had to have expertise, and we want to make sure they all do.
Nelson. Are the Senate members okay with the EQB? Right, sexy.
Yep.
We'll make progress then.
Okay. Let's make progress then.
I thought Representative Thomas thought he was ready to move there, but I'll.
I just moved.
He did.
I just moved to the EQB, but I didn't give you the makeup of your team yet.
Okay, but I think
the Senate language is probably better if we use the EQB and then use the language that's looser on the Senate side. Then,
well, I think if we use the EQB, the all members is good Senate language.
Do we want to do this now, or should we have staff actually write something up?
That's what I was going to suggest, is have the staff kind of meld the two together and come back with some language for us.
Well, Madam Chair, I think we can do that, although I think it's fairly simple.
I think this one he can do, actually.
Madam Chair and committee members, there is one significant difference in the Senate language on 65.36.
Right.
Talking about the technical team must not impose any fee or charge for the service of the technical team, which goes back to the larger funding question of how this is taken care of. The House, in its provision on R76, at the top of that page, talks about local unit of government requesting assistance from the technical team. It allows and may assess the project proposer. That's one of the difference that's in this section that spreads out more on the larger question of funding for this effort.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And what I see that Senator Schmidt is here, and maybe what I would suggest as an option is that to do this right in public, that Senator Schmidt and I go right down to those two chairs and try to work with staff and draft that out.
Nice to have a seat at the table here. I'd be amenable to that, Representative Hansen, if the chairs and the committee would agree.
Is this fee that we're talking about in the Senate side and the fee that we're talking about on the House side, are they the same fee?
Madam Chair and committee members, it's a question of how is the technical resource team funded. One, in the larger funding question, the technical assistance team and the team EQB pulls together, and the Senate is not funded at all, but then also prevents the local units of government from funding them. So at this stage, there is no funding for them overall, because the funding is based more on the rulemaking abilities set up. On the House side, they provide, and the governor provide funding for the for the teams, but then also do allow for local units of government to recoup their costs of accessing the technical team, much in the same way an EIS could be done, where the cost is borne by the proposer. So there are, it really does play into the larger question of how we are going to fund the silica sand efforts by the state and local units of government.
Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair and members, my intent with the suggestion with Senator Schmidt was not to address the funding, because we're going to have to wait until we get, but to just deal with the policy piece. If we could make progress, I think we.
The only objection I have to that is we need to move on. We need to get more stuff done. But I think we have an understanding here. So
Mr. Knopf, why don't you suggest what you think we can understand?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Thomas, I think we do have an understanding here. There are a couple of issues. I think what you're talking about is adopting EQB, as Representative Hansen mentioned earlier in the top page, R74, that the standards and criteria in different geographic regions to include that. So basically, you'd pick that up from the Senate side, but have the EQB.
Why don't we just do that right now, that part?
Madam Chair, that would be, I think, fairly easy to do. I think we'll stay with this, the house coding on where this is located. So what I think you'd want to do is there's just a slight technical word change here, but on the standards part. But I think if you moved in the sentence 64.26, the standards and criteria, and then ending with Minnesota Valley, period, if you move that into on 143.3 before these standards.
Let me ask you a question before you go any further. Why in the Senate side do we have these standards and criteria shall be different for different geographic areas of the state? Is that necessary to... Is there a way that we can do this just for southeastern Minnesota and not bring in the rest of the state?
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Thomas, that would change a lot of things in the bill on both sides if you were to do that. This was actually an amendment by Senator Schmidt in your division to add this to it at the request of some folks. This is broad. It's for basically for all silica sand, so that those counties, even outside of the air, outside of that very southeastern or to the trying to remember the driftless area, outside of the driftless area, would be able to use these teams also, and to use these standards and criteria. And this is just giving them further direction, I think.
So we can do this.
I hope so.
Well, it says so.
Do you want to go with the mayor then, or does he already have the majority?
Oh, Mr. Chair, or Madam Chair, I did that a little too soon there. It'd be 64.38 at state. There are two sentences, there are a couple of sentences there that we need to move over, actually three, I think. So it would be from 64.26, the standards, and then all the way through 62.4.30. State period, you would move those three sentences over and insert them on the House side after the period on line 143.3. So we'd add those three sentences to what's in the House side.
Okay, who would like to make that motion?
Oh, I would love to.
Okay, Senator Metzen makes that motion. We all have an understanding and agree? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposition? It's now adopted. Okay. Now we got that piece of the puzzle done. Now we can go down to the next piece of the puzzle. I think you have to take these little pieces of the puzzle separately.
I think Ms. Taylor has worked on a solution.
Madam Chair, it'd be taking the House language on for subdivision 3, lines 144.5 through 144.16 with some changes, and I will go through them. On line 144.10, delete shall and insert may. And then on 144.13, delete and the one before, then Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, and then after universities, insert and federal agencies. And then you would want to insert on line 144.14 after state agency and all members, so it would read all members have expertise. And then we could leave open the issue of the fee at this point.
I would move that.
Oh. Was that what we agreed to? I thought we agreed to the Senate language with the EQB.
Madam Chair, Senator Thomasoni, it depends if you want to be as prescriptive as the House. I mean, they're limited to seven members, so it couldn't be eight members or nine members or whatever. It would have to be, it could be no more than seven. And then they're naming agencies and then including federal agencies. And it doesn't...
doesn't have to be seven.
Yeah, I don't know if there's if they contract with a private source or whatever, it wouldn't allow... of course, it says may be chosen from the following. So it's not as prescriptive as it was with the may in there, but it is still kind of giving them direction.
Mr. Kadelka?
Madam Chair and committee members, as Mr. Knopf mentioned, there may be some other resources beyond the state and federal agencies that we would like to tap into. Our concern is just to make sure that the interpretation is wide enough that we could pull in the right folks. There might be someone from an NGO that really knows a certain aspect of karst that our agencies do not, and we would just want to make sure the language is understood to mean we could pull them into the team. We just don't want to limit our expertise.
Madam Chair, just a question on that. Mr. Kudelka, if you have somebody from an NGO or somebody else that's not defined here, couldn't they still be requested by the team to advise the team? While not comprised or being a comprising member of said team?
Madam Chair and committee members, that could occur too. We would just want to make sure that the understanding is the agencies and EQB would call upon maybe more than state agencies and feds. As long as there's an understanding there that's okay, we would be open to that. We just don't want to limit ourselves because there is some unknown in this area. We don't want to just guess that we have the expertise that we need.
Madam Chair, I'm really cautious about NGOs because each NGO has a mission. And the mission here with the EQB or the agencies, whether they're state or federal, is to provide the best technical expertise on behalf of the public. And if an NGO or an engineering firm was contracted by, but I just really cautious about an NGO being the technical assistance team in the technical assistance team.
That might be why we have no fee in our. Because they charge a lot.
Representative Hansen has a motion here.
And Madam Chair, I am not wed to up to seven members. I think if the technical assistance team may be chosen from by striking on 144.10 shall be comprised of up to seven members. So it would read from 144.9, technical assistance team may be chosen from the following entities: DNR, PCA, Board of Water and Soil Resources, Health, Department of Natural Resources, or Department of Transportation, U of M, MNSCU, and federal agencies. And then it would read, a majority of members must be from a state agency, and all members have expertise from one or more of the following areas.
Okay, I think we're getting there.
Why do we want the feds in?
May.
It says May.
I know. It seems like when the feds get in, though, we're getting all kinds of issues that we normally don't have to deal with.
But the majority of members must be from the state agency. So I think U.S. I have a lot of confidence in USGS.
Right.
That would be the one place. Okay, I'm sensing a consensus here.
Staff know what he just said? Okay.
Okay. Representative Hansen's motion is before us. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposition? It's adopted. Okay, good, guys. Let's. This issue of the fees has been set aside, but we will deal with that later. What about this? Has subdivision 4 been done? Was it?
Madam Chair, the only difference is that paragraph C on the house side on R76, which deals with assessments. But the rest of the information or the language is the same, which you could adopt and then just leave.
I think we're setting aside the fees, so it would be appropriate to do subdivision 4. 144 to 144.26. Does that seem reasonable? Would you like to make that motion?
They're the same, right?
Yeah, they're the same.
Okay.
Okay. Is somebody going to make that motion?
It's actually
Somebody did. Okay. All right. Senator Saxhawk makes that motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? That two is adopted now. So these are still set aside, but we've got moving along. Okay. We're.
I think we could, Madam Chair, move the effective date. They're the same.
Representative Hansen moves line 144 or 66. The effective dates, they are the same. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Okay. Opposition? It's adopted.
If we could hear from the Senate and the agencies on Section 75.
So this was a Senator Scoey amendment in our division, and essentially requires an EAW for any project that's being proposed with 20 acres or more of land. You can see the criteria that are involved there. Currently, an EAW is required for anything over 40 acres of land, so this brings it down to 20 acres, and it also has up until 1 year after the effective date. In other words, they have to do this for the next year after the effective date down below, which is July 1, 2013. So that's the gist of that.
Let me ask a question. It seems that this is being done so that the air quality work can be done, the restoration work rules can be done. Can they be done within that time frame?
Madam Chair and committee members, that's an excellent question. That's something that we've identified also. We kind of see this working in tandem with the rulemaking requirements later in the bill as this being a holdover. We get those in place, the various agencies, whether it's EQB, PCA, or DNR. And so the effective date we would suggest making until those other rulemaking efforts are complete on that. The other thought we have in this area is this touches only mines. There are a number of other silica sand facilities that have concerns, drying, processing, storage. There is no interim system in place to ensure the environmental impacts are looked at for those types of facilities. And so those are the two large areas there. One suggestion would be adding some other threshold triggers for that EEW for processing and storage and make those available until we are through the rulemaking process for the agencies, because the agencies could take, depending on some of those rulemakings that we've been asked to do, more than 18 months possibly.
While I was thinking about this, should we do adopt this, go at least until the agencies have adopted rules, I am cautious about agencies dragging their feet on rules.
And let me point out here that if an EAW is triggered, they're going to have to do a complete EAW. It doesn't mean that they have a year to do the EAW. It just means they have that within this next year, starting on July 1st, 2013, any new projects that are being proposed on 20 acres or more have to do an EAW. So that is a time frame in which they'll be coming up with their criteria, the technical assistance team. But the EAW, once it's triggered, has to be done completely, so there's no time limit on that. So
My question is more, this is done to be protective until the rules are in place, and we don't want an end date too long because the rules do need to be in place. But it does seem that this is a bit short to me for a rulemaking process for air quality. And are there two? Help me out here.
Madam Chair and committee members, that's a good point. On page R88, there talks about rules. It's Section 9, and it's on the Senate side, line 77.23, and I'll wait till folks get there. This is where we were talking up. I misspoke earlier, and we were corrected by folks here. This is Senate language requiring EQB to amend its environmental review categories and how environmental review is done. In this ability here, there's given the ability of the state to do some good cause exemption. Those are temporary, I believe, rules, only good for 2 years. So there could be something put in place by EQB and then allow for larger work. There's some question. There's two ways to do this. One, you could allow for more detail on Section 75, which we were just talking about on a R76, for the facilities, and allow for a larger time for the agencies to put in permanent rules. Or on this process, you could theoretically, the EQB could be doing mandatory category rules once under good cause exemption, which are limited, and then have to go in again and do another rulemaking to make them permanent. So,
could we consult this? Good cause. Bob Patton again. My understanding of the good cause exemption isn't that it's temporary, but it needs to reflect without interpretation what the statute says.
That's not right.
And so, no, so
I got a little bit different opinion here. No,
Madam Chair, the witness, Mr. Patton, there are provisions in if you look at this, it says Clause 1, and Clause 1 is to address an immediate concern. You're talking about, I think it's Clause 3, if okay. I remember right.
Okay.
And that's what this would do, and we've done this before. We did this with the wetland rules for Bowser, is give them temporary rulemaking authority, basically, to use the good cause exemption for a couple of years. They do the rules, and then basically what they do is they notify under the permanent rules that we're just going to do the same thing, or we're going to modify it slightly based on what we've seen. And it usually has gone – I mean, I think Mr. Harnack's around. He was the one who was really involved in that. And it worked pretty well for the wetland rules. So what this does is it says, you know, for 1 year we have the SCOIA provision on the 20 acres. And then this would provide the EQB a chance to pretty quickly this summer to come up with some rules that would be good for 2 years. And it does include both mining and – this one includes both mining and processing. And then they could, within that 2 years, figure out what any concerns are with the rules they've developed and then develop permanent rules. And, again, I know when Bowser has done this in the past – They just kind of show and put in the state register the changes, but they basically just adopt those temporary rules as permanent, and it's actually gone pretty smooth when we've done this with the Wetland Conservation Act rules in the past.
We're in good shape. This puts us in good shape.
Well, first of all, one of my notes to myself was on 77.23 to ask the EQB to do this by August 1st seemed too tight. What would be a date that is workable?
Madam Chair, committee members, EQB and PCA share the same rule, technical experts, and the advice we've been given is October 1st would be pushing it. We could do it by October 1st. The one concern is if we miss the date, our understanding is we lose the authority. So if we're done on October 2nd, EQB no longer has that authority. And so I think October 1st would be much preferred over August 1st for those first temporary rules there.
I just need to, Madam Chair, bring up on the temporary rules, or we did have to, I believe, go through government ops, or we may have avoided government operations by not having the expedited rule making. I know there's
we did go through
always a heartburn about that. So just on a process point there, on the content issue, if we go to 66.17. And I think there was some discussion when looking at the comparisons about what is a sand, silica sand project. And the language here as excavating 20 or more acres. And I know some of the discussion has been, maybe PCA can help on this. Are there any silica sand temporary storage areas that are greater than 20 acres?
Madam Chair, committee members, we wouldn't do it by acres. We would do it by amount of material. There are some other rules in EQB for instance, coal stockpiling and others that we would use as a basis. We have EQB and PCA staff have been putting some pen to paper. We have some preliminary thoughts on what other thresholds would be there. They could get us at least until EQB has the full time to get something done. We would not just assume 20 acres for those facilities, but different types of characteristics of them, because drying and processing is different than storage. We would want each have individual thresholds.
Chair, my concern is on 66.17, if we did just adopt Section 75, we would be relating to excavation and an acre standard. And members, I think we've got an issue relating to this overall issue with sand that's about two large sand piles in cities, Bashaw and Winona, that are generating a lot of the concern on this. And if there was a way to bring them into review, I think there was comment earlier about maybe hard if they were on railroad land, but I think the PCA just gave us some context or some suggestion that they were working on this. I'm not sure if the language that we have under Section 75 would bring it in right now.
Yeah, I have another question on this language that's, I mean, and we can work on it. Mean depth of 10 feet or more. That, I don't know whether there's any definition of what that really means. And if we are concerned about trout streams, and I know that this is one of the issues out there, that you could change the hydrology of a trout stream within 10 feet, I would think. Now, somebody can tell me I'm wrong about that.
Well, Madam Chair, I think the idea here is that if the project is going to do something like that, it then triggers the EAW. It's just a parameter of the stat of what we're trying to put into the statute here. And I think the idea of Clause A is to get at the fact that if there's a company that's proposing a project on 20 acres or more, that it automatically triggers an EAW. And then the EAW would look at the environmental impacts, and I would assume that would be water and air. And if they consider it to be extreme, then it would go to an EIS. So,
but this is the way I'm perhaps reading it differently than you are. So you're excavating at 9 feet. Can you change the hydrology of a trout stream excavating at 9 feet? I don't know the answer to that question. It's not a... hypothetical.
Madam Chair, can I just mention where we got the language for that? That is in the current rule. But right now it says 40 acres or more,
right,
into a mean depth of 10 feet. That's the board's rule right now. It's to a mean depth of 10 feet.
But we didn't understand the hydrology of trout streams 5 years ago. so that's the issue.
There is sand in the trout streams, yeah.
You get little critters in there, too.
But it appears to me, if this is the language that we're using now, the idea here was to cut in half the size of a project that would trigger an EAW.
I think that I'm amenable to that, except I wonder if we should just take out mean depth of 10 feet or more and just 20 or more acres of land. That was my question. And so I...
Sounds like it's working, though. Sounds like it's working.
Well, we don't know. That's the problem. Is this... So I
maybe this can the industry comment on that then? Maybe I don't know if you have a comment or not, but or does the PCA comment on it? I mean, because since it is in rule already.
How old is the rule?
Bob Patton again. My comment is just I think the reason it's there is just to define what excavate means. You know, that you're excavating some volume, and so it could introduce a little bit of ambiguity if there's no number there, but it's beyond my expertise what affects trout streams.
Well, how old is the rule?
Yes, it does follows the rule right now.
No, how old is
it? How old is the rule? I would have to look that up when that provision was adopted. It may go back quite a ways.
That's one of the issues that we are only beginning to understand hydrology now. Right. And that's so some of the things we did in the past, we did without understanding some of their impacts. But I do see an expert sitting at the table.
Madam Chair, members, Jason Meckel, Department of Natural Resources, for the record. I think that your suggestion of removing mean depth makes sense. Mean depth might mean I go 20 feet in one area, 2 feet somewhere else. And as you described, it's the underground fractures and fissures in this landscape that is the area that we're most uncertain about. And our experience has been that we intercept these flow paths because we don't know where they are. So mean depth might mean you could be very deep in one area of where you're, and then tapping into one of these flows.
So, Mr. Chair, I am amenable to your language, but I would like to take out the mean depth of 10 feet or more. It's just if they're going to excavate. I don't know about my House members. Are you amenable to the Senate's this part of the language? We're going to do this section by section because it's.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm still interested in temporary storage issue in urban areas, and I'd like to hear from the agencies a little more. If this is environmental review, I'm interested in expanding the definition of project.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is David Thornton from the Pollution Control Agency. As Mr. Kudelka said, we have had some folks meeting and discussing potential thresholds. The impetus behind that was the August 1st date that's in the version of the bill, and knowing that we had to hit the ground running in order to try to even come close to meeting that with exempt rulemaking. And one of the things that we came up with as a potential threshold would be, for example, using 6 trucks per hour as an amount that would be not only noticeable to people, but moving quite a bit of product. And so one threshold that we suggested was a facility capable of storing more than 7,500 tons of silica sand with an annual throughput of more than 125,000 tons of silica sand. And that, again, equates to about a 6 truck per hour activity. A facility designed or capable of transferring more than 1,650 tons of silica sand per calendar day, or more than 20 250,000 tons annually from one mode of transportation to another. So that would be the loading facility. And designed or capable of processing more than 1,650 tons of sand a day, that would be the drying and washing and sorting facility in case they're all located on separate sites. And then for storage, we decided that for now, without any better information, that we could use the same thresholds for environmental review for coal storage, which is 77,500 tons or an annual throughput of 125,000 tons. So for the transfer and processing facilities, using a 6-truck per hour as the measure, and for storage facilities, the same thresholds as are currently in rules for coal, essentially.
Are you suggesting that be in the bill, or is that a suggestion for what the rules might be?
Well, it could be in the bill, Senator, and as a temporary until rules are developed. If it's not, it's certainly our starting point in terms of thinking what the rule might look like. The other option that we considered was just require environmental review for any facility that's going to be doing anything with silica sand for that short period of time between the passage of the statute and the exempt rules are promulgated in, hopefully October, not August. And then you'd catch everything that's going to happen, and they're going to be mostly sized of a certain size, so I don't think it's an overreach to do that. And then we would have the exempt rules coming in for a period of time, and then eventually more carefully thought out permanent rules.
Members, it seems we're getting there. Why don't we take a 10-minute recess so that people can do whatever they want to do, and if staff could do some writing at that as we are taking a 10-minute recess. We're recessing.
How much?
No, I didn't say
that. There will be peace and understanding. So we're all wondering what you got. I got fog here.
I did not say that. I did not hear that.
You're going up north, man? That's
you. You're going up north. Fog yourself. How about you?
Check your brain.
You're fine. You see
Hey, ho.
I'm very easy.
Okay. We are back in. We know that it's going to take more than 10 minutes or 15 minutes to deal with the silica sand issue and complete it, but we're making progress here. So I think instead of that, we understand somebody has driven down from Duluth, so we would like to, when council one or the other comes back, we will. Let's wait for a minute.
Here comes Kanaan. Yeah, we can't go without you.
Sorry.
No, that's all right.
There will be peace.
That's just going to the casino.
Go to
members, There was language in the House and Senate bills dealing with forced nurseries. Somebody has driven down from Duluth to chat about that, so I think we are going to hear from them. Welcome them to the committee. And if staff would like to point out for us, there are provisions in the House and provisions in the Senate that are different, and if staff could just remind us of those, where they are and what the differences are.
Madam Chair, the policy language regarding the nurseries is on page R89 of Article 4. It's the
R89? Just a moment. R89.
And it's just the repealer on 78.7 paragraph B on the Senate side.
Okay. You also have a problem. That's the Senate side.
Yep. And then on the House side, it'd be in Article 3. That'd be R23. Line 61.5 through 61.30, requiring a report.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. Tim Power, Minnesota Nursery and Landscape Association. The House bill, of course, creates a report, an appropriation, and requires a report. The Senate bill includes a repealer. Representing the Minnesota Nursery and Landscape Association, from our perspective, the 2011 session law was passed as a compromise in which the state forest nurseries stayed open, but that committed DNR to meeting both their break-even mandate and consolidating their seedling growing operations at the Bedora Nursery while retooling the General Andrews Nursery for seed orchard, seed improvement activities, seedling storage, etc. As a result of the 2011 session law, our commercial seedling growers ramped up their seedling production to meet the expected additional demand for their seedlings. These are mostly small, family-owned businesses that would be negatively impacted in a major way by a repeal of the session law implemented 2 years ago. The repealer language in the Senate Environment Bill was never heard in a policy or finance committee. The bill that was heard and passed by a Senate committee was Senate File 57, Senator Saxhog's bill that would have allowed the continued sale of seedlings from the state forest nurseries to soil and water conservation districts. Senate File 57 was amended in the Senate Environment and Energy Committee to allow only the sale of coniferous stock from the state forest nurseries to the SWCDs, a change that MNLA supported then and would prefer today. But even the original language of the of Senator Saxhog's bill would be a much better deal for the Minnesota Nursery and Landscape Association members than the repealer that is currently in the Senate Environment Policy Bill. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'd love to answer questions after Mr. Ninus is complete.
Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I want to thank you for the opportunity to be here today and to say a few words in regards to the state nurseries on behalf of the Minnesota Soil and Water Conservation Districts. In the past, soil and water conservation districts were allowed to purchase seedlings from the state nurseries and to resell them to the public for conservation programs. In the fall of 2011, the Carlton County Soil and Water District conducted a statewide five-year tree seedling survey. 39 out of the 91 soil and water conservation districts replied to our survey. We found that statewide soil and water districts purchased between 250 and 300,000 seedlings each year from our state nurseries. By state statute, we know the state nursery program is required to operate at a break-even level within the structure of government enterprise funding. By allowing the Soil and Water District statewide to purchase seedlings from the state nurseries, we will help keep them financially solvent. In talking with the DNR, I'm told that the purchasing of those 250 to 300,000 seedlings generated about $100,000 worth of revenue for the state nurseries. Soil and Water Districts work with private landowners on a number of different types of projects each year. It might be a windbreak around a home, a living snow fence, a windbreak on ag land to help prevent soil erosion, or for wildlife habitat, just to name a few of our projects. Each one of our projects requires that we plant the right tree in the right place for the right purpose and at the right price. The seedling should be grown from a local seed source, well adapted to thrive in our local climates and be disease resistant. The state nurseries provide Soil and Water Districts with carefully labeled and documented seedlings. This allows Soil and Water Districts to plant in the state's various zones where the seeds originated. No other business in Minnesota, private or public, operates a seed production facility on this scale. Under the current law, excess plant material may be sold or traded to private sector wholesale nurseries. If Soil and Water Districts are forced to purchase state-grown seedlings from the private sector nurseries, it will greatly increase the cost to the private landowners for doing a number of these projects. We would like to see actually the repeal language passed that the Senate has provided, but we would also like, in the perfect world, to see the language that the House adopted too. And we do say that because we have had an excellent working relationship with the private sector. We feel that with the study that is being recommended on the House side, that we'll be able to get together with all the parties, iron out our differences, and once and for all put this subject to bed so that we don't end up here every 2 years trying to define which direction we're going. So I would urge everybody, if at all possible, to support the repeal language that's in the Senate so that we can go back to doing our projects with that product right from the state nurseries. The private landowners that I visited with kind of take offense to having to buy state stock from private sector nurseries and pay an additional fee because of that. So we're here to answer any questions you might have.
Madam Chair, I appreciate the testimony of both the gentlemen, but would like to hear from the Forrest Bowles here.
Thank you for testifying. We appreciate your coming down.
Madam Chair, Senator Saxog.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Bowles. The question that I kind of have is, what was the plan simply based on the 2011 session law, and how do you think, how will that change with the repeal or won't it?
Madam Chair, Senator Saxog, for the record, Forrest Bowles, Director of Forestry. The plan in the 2011 session law restricted the state forest nurseries from producing seedlings that we would sell to private landowners unless their land was under a permanent conservation easement. It didn't change the self-sufficiency of the nursery operations, and also required us to do a study that was a budget and financial plan that was submitted in 2012. The 2011 session law did not restructure any of the existing statutes that govern how we operate our nurseries.
So Madam Chair, and Mr. Bowles, given the repealer, what would change?
Madam Chair.
Or do you have a, with your study and the way that you're doing things now, well, just tell me how you could, what you visualize.
Madam Chair, Senator Saxok, what would change it? It would allow us to continue to sell to the SWCDs, and it would allow us to eventually sell to the private landowners again. We have not sown seed at General Andrews since, I think it was 2010. We're really not in a position to, we don't have those seedlings available to sell right away. So I think those would certainly be two changes. We would not be able to meet the demands immediately. You know, we're really looking at repurposing that General Andrews nursery at this point. As Tim had said, it's really a seed improvement area, and we would certainly need to develop some kind of transition plan along with the Minnesota Landscape Association to meet the demands that are out there. Overall, we've seen a decrease in demand as conservation programs kind of dry up. Both federal and state money have dried up, and we don't see as much pressure to produce those seedlings. The overall seedling production has gone down because of the reduction in conservation programs.
Well, Madam Chair, I guess I think the repealer is going to be okay, and I don't see any indication that DNR is going back to doing the things before that made it tough on the private landscapers. So it sounds to me like the DNR is going down a path, and you would the House would advocate for another study. Is that it?
We asked Forrest, and this is on R23 and Article 3, we asked Forrest Bowe and his group to get a plan for us, and that this language was written by them.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I think we heard a pretty good suggestion. Let's take both the House and Senate language and get it done from there.
That seems to be what would be called perfect.
Okay. World.
Okay. So, in a perfect world, since we are going to do one thing perfectly here,
we've done more than that.
Pardon?
We've done more than this thing perfectly.
Okay.
But this is a perfect world. Oh, this is a perfect world, yes.
Senator Tomassoni moves that we adopt both the House and the Senate language. I see no further discussion. All those in favor say aye.
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 The opposition.
Madam Chair, I would just like to thank you for that action on behalf of the Soil and Water Districts.
Thank you, and thanks for coming. Okay, we have a few more minutes to work. We deviated a little bit. I think let's go back and just check what's left in PCA that hasn't been done in life.
Madam Chair, there's the silica sand ordinance permit library on R76 and 77. If we skip over that other piece we had been working on, that would be the next section.
Should we wait on silica sand until we get everything
dealt with? We skip over silica sand, then what would we be doing?
The next section would be on R86, the wastewater reuse. This is also in the section 109,
yeah, buddy.
Requiring the PCA to use certain criteria.
Drafted PCA's request. Some different language here. We could hand it out and look at it. Basically, what the House is proposing to do is to have encouragement for new wastewater treatment systems
to gear up so that their water can be reused, irrigation or whatever. And PCA is working on this issue in rulemaking, but we know the time rules take, so this has been a pretty hard house position. So we have redrafted many times to work so it's suitable for the PCA. I think we have gotten it to that point of being suitable for the PCA. Basically, we're just encouraging, there's no mandate here, but encouraging folks to build or rebuild their wastewater treatment systems to design them for reuse.
I do.
What's with the points? Is that for PFA?
PCA.
Madam Chair, committee members, for the record again, Kirk Adalco with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. I don't have a copy of the language, but if it's the wastewater beneficial reuse language, that is points for ranking on the PPL, which is the priority listing that PFA uses to fund their projects, and that this would temporarily put in place until the agency finishes its rulemaking 30 points for those that do beneficial reuse. We believe this is the way to go to help encourage the reuse of water from wastewater treatment facilities. There is already in statute 20 points for land application of reuse of water. This would allow for industrial uses. Say a facility wanted to use its cooling water, wastewater for its cooling water, this would help encourage that type of activity and reduce the amount of surface and groundwater being used.
I will point out the way this is written, this is, I mean, if you adopt rules, you could repeal this, but this is just statutory, and it gives you the base for writing the rules so you don't have to spend a ton of money writing a sonar to justify this because the statute gives you the authority. And if you want to change it later, it says up at least 30 points.
Madam Chair, just to that point, it says at least 30 points. So they couldn't go lower than 30 points
right,
in their
but
rules.
That's what they had wanted. This was they had suggested 30 points to us.
And so
at some point, years down the line, they wanted to do 35 points, they could do that too.
But Madam Chair, they couldn't do 15 points or 20
right.
points.
Anybody have any objections?
Need a motion. I'll support.
Senator Metzen moves that we adopt this language in replace of what is here and moves it into the bill. All those in, this is the new section 109. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? It's adopted.
The next section is another silica sand. It's the rulemaking, so if you'd like to skip over that, we could move to the fugitive emission section on R88.
This is our gift to the Senate.
I like gifts. I like gifts.
That's it.
This is Representative Ansel's.
That's section 117. Move it.
Madam Chair, I'll just point out Senator Saxhog has this bill in the Senate 1092, and it reads identical to Senator Saxhog's bill.
Beautiful.
To 117.
I think I'm hearing a consensus.
Yep.
Yes.
Representative Hansen moves 17. Those in favor say aye.
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 Any opposition? No opposition, and this is adopted.
Madam Chair, the next section is also a silica sand related section on interim ordinances, so we could skip over that, and then the next piece would be the repealers. And for the most part, the House and Senate are the same on the PCA rules, so you could adopt those. But if you remember when we were going through the DNR section, there are two DNR rules that are being repealed related to the Halls Island issue.
We will have to separate that out.
So, Madam Chair, if you wanted, you could move the House repeal of the Minnesota rules sections only, since we do not have those.
And those are all the same?
They're all the same.
Okay.
Representative Hansen moves the House provision, section 118. Questions? I don't see any. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? That's adopted.
Good work for today.
Yeah. You think we're finished?
I think we could be.
Chair, I think there were some ATV provisions that were folks in the audience that were on one side, but I don't think they were controversial. Maybe we can get those out of the way if you were moving towards adjournment there.
I think we are moving that way.
Is it someone in the audience that came from somewhere far away, or are they?
They look pretty close.
They look pretty close.
Easier every day.
And he's smiling. He can tell.
Real tall.
I think we're going to.
There you go.
And set a time. Well, we don't have. We will be meeting Monday and Tuesday.
you absolutely will be because we got to get this done. So.
Right.
All right.
Hopefully we'll have some money, too.
That's some money, honey.
Happy Mother's Day, everybody.
Happy Mother's Day.
Good fishing, too.
Have a good weekend.
Yeah, thanks, interview.
Happy Mother's Day.